Hi, everybody at all our sites and online. We're launching a new series this weekend. It's about commitment. It's about the power, the amazing power of commitment in a human life. It's about the nobility of being a commitment-making, commitment-honoring, commitment-keeping human being. But I understand we live in a kind of a keep your options open, always have an exit strategy, never get tied down world. So we were trying to think about where could we do a message about this subject where even the most commitment phobic person would not get cold sweats. And that's why I'm actually in a singles bar. Now I have to tell you, this is a big stretch for me. I grew up a church kid, Baptist church in the Midwest. I knew bars were sinful. I was pretty sure sinful people, single people were sinful. Put them together and you might as well live in California. And now I do live in California. And it's about as wild as I always knew it would be. You never know who you're going to run into at a place like this.
Oh, can I get you anything to drink?
No, I'm just drinking water. But I wish if you were going to have a second job, you'd go be a chaplain or something, Frank. Thank you, anyways. Some of you are looking at this thinking, that looks like a nice singles bar. Wonder where it is. I'm not going to tell you you're in church. Some of you are thinking, I think I know where that place is. Don't tell anybody you're in church. In fact, quick time out here, if you're single and you're sincerely wanting to know more about God, but you'd also love to find a life partner and you're wondering, is it okay if part of the reason why I'm in church is I'd love to find somebody who might be, you know, my husband or my wife, is that okay? Absolutely. I gotta say, our church is a great place to meet someone. In fact, go ahead and look around right now. And if you see somebody that looks promising and you want to change seats, go ahead. I was thinking sometimes bars do better than churches do at saying, everybody's welcome. Nobody's perfect. And if you're single, sometimes it can feel like bars are designed for single people, but churches are designed for married people. And that's not God's plan. Jesus, in fact, was a single guy, and the church is his church. So I'm really glad you're in church right now and not a bar. And one of our commitments is to be a place where married people, single people, young people, old people, every color, everything are welcome. But to be real frank, I'm kind of the worst authority in the world about what kind of conversations actually would go on in a singles bar. I was never any good even at talking to girls in a church. But I wanted to be here in this space because I think this evokes or symbolizes thoughts and fears that a lot of people have when they think about commitment and God and church and faith. Commitment can be a real scary word. Sometimes, even when the commitment is a small deal, probably nobody else ever hears this, but sometimes with one of our kids in our family, we'll have a conversation that kind of goes like this. Want to come over for dinner tonight? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. And what's just underneath that is, I might get a better offer. And then if I'm already committed to you, I'd be missing out on that, and I wouldn't want to miss out on that. Or it could be a bigger deal. Want to get married? I don't know. Maybe. Might get a better offer. Want to commit to God? Want to commit financially to tithing? Want to join a church and commit to a community? Do you want to make a commitment that if you do get married, you'll only marry somebody who shares your faith in God? Do you want to voluntarily commit a chunk of your time in unglamorous service of under-resourced people? See, making a commitment, I get it, is scary because a commitment is a promise about the future, but in the future, things might change. What if I promise to marry you, but then I change? What if I promise to marry you, but then you change? What if I promise to be your friend, but we have a fight or I don't feel close to you? What if I promise to follow God, but tomorrow I don't feel like following God? I'm not even sure there is a God. See, another word for uncommitted, the word that we all love, that we obsess over, is free. I gotta be free. The commitment phobe is afraid of missing out on something. And as long as I'm not committed, then I'm free to grab it, free to see whoever I want, to eat whatever I want, free to do whatever I choose, buy whatever looks good, say whatever seems useful, experience anything I desire. So the way to be free, according to conventional wisdom, is whatever you do, avoid commitment. Don't get committed. But there's a minority opinion. In this minority opinion, guys, commitment makers, commitment keepers, will experience a kind of freedom that commitment avoiders will never ever know. The Christian writer G.K. Chesterton wrote a fabulous essay where he said, "The man who makes a vow makes an appointment with himself at some distant time or place. In the act of commitment, I bind myself to that future moment. I am not free to love another woman. I am not free to spend that money on me. I am not free to follow another God. And yet, somehow, that not free commitment leads to a deeper freedom than all the options and escape clauses in a commitment-phobic world. It's the commitment maker who gains freedom for love and growth and community and meaning. The commitment avoider becomes a slave to whatever desire comes along, to a life of small, petty sins. This minority opinion got expressed a long time ago. Jesus put it like this: if you obey my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. In other words, if you commit yourself to obedience, that will actually lead you into freedom to be the person God made you to be. If you think you're free to do whatever you want, you end up a slave to sin. So making a commitment, even though it's hard work, is nothing to be afraid of. Making the right commitment in the right spirit to the right obligation or assignment or value or person is one of the noblest things a human being can do. And the reason that we're drawn to make commitments is that we alone, of all the creatures God made, were made in the image of a commitment-making, commitment-keeping God. Only human beings can do this. Only human beings can make a promise. Only human beings can say, I will meet you next Tuesday. I will serve on that team with you. I will keep that secret. I will be your friend. I will pray for you. I will have your back. You can count on me. A dog can't make that promise. If they could, they would, and they would die to keep it, but they can't. A cat can't make a promise. If they could, they would. And then they would break it, and they would laugh in your face in their quiet cat way. People who follow God are commitment makers. Not just that. People who follow God make what look from the outside like outrageous commitments, and they do it with fierce joy. And we're going to look at one such person today. And then over the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at the incredible power of God-powered commitment in our financial lives and in our relational lives. And then we're going to look at God's commitment to us. But for today, I want to invite you to consider your deepest commitments. So, in a book in the Old Testament, it's called 1 Kings, there's a prophet named Elijah, and he's coming to the end of his ministry, so he's looking for a replacement. So Elijah went from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. Elisha then left his oxen and ran after Elijah. Let me kiss my father and mother goodbye, he said. Then I will come with you. Go back, Elijah replied. What have I done to you? Now, this is a very, very dramatic moment. Elijah's an old man. He's standing in the field. There's plowing going on. He lets 11 pair of oxen go by. And then he walks to Elisha. He takes off his mantle. The mantle is a symbol of his calling, of his office, of his life's work. And he throws it on Elisha. The meaning is real clear. Elisha, God has a job for you. Leave all this. Now, this leaves out a lot of details that I would want to know about if I were thinking about taking on a job like this. What's the health plan like? How many weeks of vacation would he get? If Elisha's going to be a prophet, and Elijah already is a prophet, would there be some kind of a prophet-sharing plan? Are you groaning? I hope you're groaning. We do know that Elisha has 12 teams of oxen at work. And what this means in that economy is Elisha is a person of staggering wealth. In other words, he's got options. He's got possibilities. He's got a real bright future. He's a golden boy. He can have any girl in the village he wants. Leave all that to attach himself to a penniless preacher and face a life of opposition and danger and sacrifice? Seriously? What's he going to do if something better comes along? And something better will come along. He's got 12 teams of oxen, 24 oxen. So there's this very dramatic moment, and Elisha has one request. He says, let me go kiss my mother and father goodbye, and then I will come to you. Now, this is super reasonable. And Elijah's response seems a little bit edgy. Go ahead, what have I done to you? You can hear the wheels turning in Elijah's mind. You know, I bet if he runs home to mommy and daddy, they'll remind him of the trust fund and the keys to the car and the vacation home. He's going to bail. I'll probably never see him again. But he does something very important. He gives Elisha the space to make the commitment himself. No pressure, no manipulation. You must decide. And a good church will do that with people when it comes to God and commitment. You must decide. And Elisha does. Elisha decides to say yes to God. Elisha comes back and he says to Elijah, I'm all set. There's just one more thing I have to do. I love this. He took his yoke of oxen and he slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah and become his servant. He burns the plow. Get it? He comes back to Elijah. He's all in. And he says, well, what shall I do with these oxen? And he kills them. The oxen don't like that part of the story. But the idea here is he's going to offer a sacrifice to God that represents, that expresses, he's really offering his life as a sacrifice to God. And then he decides to turn this sacrifice into a party, and he gives the meat to all the people. Do you have any idea how many people you can feed with two oxen? You know, like one side of beef is huge. And one of the best things you can do, see, if you're really serious about keeping a commitment, is go public with it. And he's going public big time. But if kissing his parents goodbye and killing his ox and offering a sacrifice and going public isn't enough for him, he does one more thing. He burns the plow. You get what that means? There's no going back. I cannot return to my old life. I burn the plow. When Elijah leaves him and Elisha's all alone, I can't go back. I burn the plow. When a bunch of boys mock him, which they will, and he calls a bear out to chase them and maul them, and he thinks, I'll never be a man of God. I'll never get this right. He says to himself, I can't go back. I burn the plow. When the king wants to kill him, when the Arameans surround him, when a famine is starving him, when Israel rejects him so utterly that he weeps at his failure, the one thing he knows is, I can't go back. I burn the plow. That way of life is cut off from me. There is no retreat. That's commitment. Plow burning commitment. Some of you will know about this story. In 1519, a conquistador, Hernan Cortez, landed in Veracruz in Mexico to win glory in the New World. He came from Spain with 500 soldiers and 100 sailors on 11 ships. When they landed, they were filled with uncertainty and fear. This is the New World, and some of them wanted to go back. And so he gave an order to his men, burn the ships. In other words, going back ain't an option. We will succeed or we will die. We will flourish or we will perish, but we will not run away. We are committed. Burn the ships. Now, this story gets spread a lot. It's kind of a motivational speaker story because we're a church and the truth thing is a big deal for us. I have to say a couple of comments. They didn't actually burn the ships. They scuttled them. And they left one ship intact to bring treasure back to Spain and maybe bring back a few leaders if it didn't all work out. And it turns out that Cortez wasn't all that nice to the Aztecs, to the people already living in the New World. And that's important because we're not called to glorify commitment. If commitment's attached to the wrong thing, it can do a lot of damage. If a football player has an overpowering commitment to win the Super Bowl, whatever it takes, but a non-commitment to obey God by honoring his wife, if a business person has an unquenchable commitment to my success, but a quenchable commitment to my family, see, that's actually idolatry. Ultimate commitment to a non-ultimate value, that's idolatry. But when a human being makes an outrageous commitment to a noble calling of this supremely worthy God, when an ordinary human being says, I don't care how hard it gets, I don't care how high the cost, I am not going back, I am not turning around, I have charbroiled the ox, I've kissed off the trust fund, I've given up the keys, the ships are smoking in the harbor, I burned the plow. A power gets released on this earth beyond merely human capacity. So church, I'm asking you, where is God calling you to burn the plow? Maybe it's in your relational or your sexual life. when I was Googling singles bars, which I'd never done before, I came across this line: discover the top places to pick up the other lonely hearts in the Bay Area looking for their next pickup. Maybe you'd say, in a pickup hookup culture, I'm making a commitment. I'm vowing not to be sexually intimate to a person outside of the commitment, the covenant of marriage. Maybe you're married, but that commitment has been kind of shaky. When Nancy and I got married, we had only one premarital session to cover money, sex, conflict, in-laws, parenting, goals, division of labor, expectations. I don't recommend that. We needed a lot more. And at one point, the guy counseling us asked, what will you do if you wake up one morning and your feelings of love for each other are gone? And Nancy immediately said, I will honor my commitment. That was the wrong answer to me back then. The right answer to me back then was, we are so special and so magic. I am so special and so magic that the feelings of love will never go away. They couldn't go away. They might for ordinary people, but not for me. They will only grow more special and more magic every day. So the idea that you would have to stay with me out of commitment, that's the wrong answer. And I let Nancy know that this was the wrong answer by pouting. I have the spiritual gift of pouting. If I were a superhero, it would be my superpower. It's better than it once was, but it's done damage to our marriage many times over the years. But Nancy has kept loving me. You know how? She honors her commitment. Now, honoring your commitment in a marriage doesn't mean I'm going to be a martyr. It's going to be so hard. It doesn't mean saying, what a noble human being I am to continue to endure a pouter like you. No, it's 1,000 little commitments that are powered by God. I'll listen. I'll give. I'll fight. Honestly, I'll make up. I won't go surfing where I shouldn't on the internet. I won't go flirting in a bar. I won't go escaping in a bottle or with a screen. I made a promise, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. I burn the plow. Guys, if you're married, have you burned the plow? Maybe it's your commitment to a child. I was reading a book about kind of corporate mission the other day that had an interesting statement. The author said, you hear this a lot, the corporation has become in our day what the family used to be 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And I want to say, no, it hasn't. See, in a company, if you get a pink slip, go to your supervisor and say, hey, you can't do this to me. I'm family. And he'll say, no, you used to be family. Now you're fired. In a good family, you can't get fired. That's one of the differences between a family and a company. You might want to write that down. Guys, what makes a family is not the birth of a child. What makes a family is a promise. I'm your dad. I'm your mom. You might do anything. You might betray my values. You might deny my God. You might break my heart. I'll still be your dad. I will never stop loving you. Maybe work or disappointment or anger or busyness has been causing you to break your promise as a mom or a dad. Maybe you've gotten a little lax on your commitment to help your children know God, to be part of a spiritual community every week. You know, we have so many people who give lives, energy, who have committed themselves to be part of a spiritual community as a church where through Menlo Kids, your children can be a part of a little group that knows them and loves them and helps them know that God loves them, and to make a commitment, to put a stake in the ground, to say every week, I'm going to be here, make sure my kids are here. Maybe that's been getting a little loose. Maybe it's time to burn the plow. Maybe, like Elisha, God's calling you to make your life an act of service to him. Our church has seen kind of a clinic in that recently. A lot of you know Bob Arrington. Bob has led a ministry called Safe at Home. And he's been on countless mission trips. A few weeks ago, he went into the hospital to have some symptoms checked out, and they told him his body was full of cancer, and that he just had a very short time to live. And there was this parade of people that Bob has helped that just went on nonstop. And so many leaders of so many under-resourced ministries and churches in the Bay Area came to tell Bob how much his commitment meant to them, how much they loved him. That when Dave Peterson from our staff got there, somebody told Dave, it was like what they realized is Bob Arrington is the Pope of East Palo Alto. And Dave, no kidding, actually got down on his knees and crawled across that hospital room to kiss the Pope's hand. See, Bob didn't lead a life of saying, I'm not committed. I just want to keep my time and my energy and my money free. Bob wasn't free. Bob burned the plow. But guys, it's so strange how so many people who live for so much freedom get to the end of their lives and they can't remember what they did with all that money they were free to make and spend. They can't remember how they used all that time they were so busy protecting. They can't remember what even happened to all those relationships that they were so free to exit. And in the end, where they didn't have to commit to anything, they ended up with a life committed to nothing. It is not in our freedom, but in our commitments that we find ourselves. I am the one who committed myself to Nancy, and to Laura and Mallory and Johnny, and to my work, my ministry, and to my good friends, Rick and Chuck, and to my God, to my Lord Jesus. Now, maybe you hear this and what you feel inside is, God, I'm an inadequate commitment keeper. I've just blown it too many times. And I get that. We all wrestle with that. I decided that this year I would work on a commitment to honesty, that I would try to spend some time every day assessing, have I been honest? That's a commitment that we're all called to as followers of Jesus. And just as decent human beings, in the Bible, there's a statement that goes, truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue lasts only a moment. So, January 1st, our whole family was driving up from Southern California, and I'm driving and I'm working on memorizing sermons these days. So I thought I'll do that in the car while everybody else in the family sleep, and they always sleep. And I had the transcript of the sermon on my lap so that I could glance down on it. Mostly I'm looking at the road, but I could just glance down quickly. And it's this sermon. So I'm working on it, and I get to the end of the page, and I switch pages. But my daughter, my foolish daughter, stayed awake, which she never does in the car. And she said, Dad, what are you doing? Are you reading while you're driving? And I said, no. And she said, well, then why did you just put the top page on the bottom of the stack? And all I could think of was, why are you awake? You're not supposed to be awake. You're grounded. I don't care if you are 30 years old. It's January 1st, and I'm committed to a year of honesty, and I'm already lying to my family about a sermon about honesty. Here's the deal. When I blow a commitment January 1st, I begin again January 2nd. When I blow off a vow that I made at 10 o'clock, I begin again at 10:01 because of something called grace. Because our God is a commitment-keeping God. And when we fail, when we fall down, when we do not keep our commitments to Him, He keeps His commitment to us all the more at the cost of a cross where Jesus died. See, the big commitment, the ultimate commitment that a human being can make, the one that is worth your life and death, is the commitment to love and follow this Jesus who is infinitely committed to you. So if you're visiting this weekend or watching online and you're not a follower of Jesus, if you're just thinking about the faith, I hope you'll consider this. I hope you think about the role of commitment and commitment to Jesus above all in human life. If you're part of our church, if you're a follower of Jesus, guys, I gotta tell you, I hope, I pray, I ache that we will be the kind of church that thrills to be called to total and outrageous commitment to Jesus, that doesn't just come to hear, you know, God loves you just the way you are. It's okay, go back out and lead the same foolish life next week and then come back next week and you hear again, God loves you no matter what. He does love you no matter what. But I hope it'll be the kind of place where we love to be called to outrageous commitment to Jesus, not because we're these noble, committed types or we're better than other people, just for one reason. Because Jesus came to earth and nothing better is coming along. Jesus himself is so humble that if a better way than his were to come along, Jesus is the first person who would say, take it. But nothing better has come along for 2,000 years, and I'll tell you a little secret, it ain't coming tomorrow. Here's the call. These words, guys, I love so much. They remind me of that man, Elisha, who burned the plow, and they make me think about the plows that I want to burn. There is an announcement. Here it is. All around us is the city of small sins, abounding in back ways and retreats. But surely, sooner or later, the towering flame will rise from the harbor, announcing that the reign of the cowards is over, and a man is burning his ships. Burn the plow.